June marks Pride Month, when many are celebrating some of the milestones in the fight for LGBTQ rights. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Much has been achieved since the Stonewall Rebellion of 1969. Same-sex marriage is now the law of the land, and the issue of gays in the military is now part of history, and many speak of achieving some sort of dignity. But a new book entitled Disrupting Dignity, Rethinking Power and Progress in LGBTQ Lives, explores this question. Timothy Lyle has co-authored the book with Stephen Engel, and we have Lyle on the phone this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So, well, let's get at the concept of dignity. What are you getting at in terms of that particular word?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, we, as you just noted, you know, all of the sort of cornerstone markers of LGBT equality over the past several years have sort of been anchored by this idea of dignity. And, you know, we saw the term popping up in constitutional law and public health policy and sort of cultural representation and increased visibility. And, you know, everybody sort of thinks about dignity as this sort of unalloyed good, you know, this kind of unquestioned positive trait. And, you know, we wanted to sort of defamiliarize that concept a little bit, kind of open that conversation up to ask if perhaps dignity has a darker side, has an underbelly. And we examined the way the term has been used in the domains of law and pop culture and public health to sort of look at the ways in which it actually has functioned as a boundary-making tool, has actually functioned to sort of create hierarchies in LGBTQ communities and kind of delineate who counts and who doesn't, who has value and who might not. Who's protected and who may be more vulnerable. So we kind of came at the space, you know, from trying to take something that's commonplace and get people to think a little bit differently about it.
Well, I want to turn to pop culture because that's the thing that probably most people will be familiar with or interact with. And I want to focus on the film Love, Simon. And one of the quotes in the film, I guess, is he says, "I'm just like you for the most part. My life is totally normal." And in that sentence, he seems to indicate that there's something abnormal about him. Go into a bit about that, because you talk about this idea of acceptance of gays and lesbians and others, but in a particular format rather than who they may really be.
Yeah. In the context of pop culture, we point to the 2018 film Love, Simon as a clear example of maintaining respectability by sort of having a refusal of kind of queer excess. I mean, Simon literally says that at one point in the film, "not that gay," as a kind of critical moment of his own, you know, self-reflection. And often the film sort of reduces queer identity to only a matter of sexual object choice and partner choice, and sort of refuses to engage with or even acknowledge collective queer histories or queer subcultures, queer ways of thinking and being in the world, and sort of papers over a lot of inequalities and inequities through a kind of superficial treatment of difference. I mean, you know, kind of the key thrust of the film and really a lot of marketplace-ready representations of queer life revolve around narratives that minimize difference, you know, and that sort of cater to the needs and the wants of mainstream audiences, which unfortunately oftentimes, you know, kind of contorts queer life and erases queer histories and can sort of present only one model of a kind of acceptable LGBTQ person and thereby a lot of, you know, other folks sort of get tossed to the side who may not, you know, look like Simon or live like Simon, you know, who may want to embrace that excess and be that gay. You know, and it's interesting, the film actually has a counter narrative to Simon, which is a gender non-conforming black queer kid by the name of Ethan, who is kind of abjected by the film. And, you know, Simon sort of is able to kind of clean himself off on Ethan by presenting himself as the right kind of gay, and thereby the more vulnerable member of the queer community is left without the kind of access that Simon eventually gets, without the kind of safety that Simon gets from the school and from parents. And so, you know, the film really kind of served as a great example of why we should be cautious in celebrating these visibility wins without some serious questions about at what cost, and particularly who has to pay that cost in our community.
How do you see this in contrast to something, say, the Will and Grace program, which was hailed by many? And yet when I think about that program in particular, everybody seems, as you might describe it, as, quote, normal, that there's a certain flamboyance, I think, with one of the characters. But in general speaking, everybody looks like they came out of society like everybody else in the heterosexual world.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we don't specifically write about Will and Grace aside from a couple of footnotes for historical context, but, you know, I do think you're right. I mean, there's a similar tendency there to assuage the fears of mainstream audiences, to make, well, particularly gays and lesbians at that point, palatable, right? And the way that they do that is often by presenting very white characters, very middle to upper class characters, you know, characters that are not necessarily situated in a lot of specifically queer spaces, and sort of queer histories and queer vernaculars and so on. You know, or the other kind of way that that's accomplished is turning to familiar tropes of queerness that make, you know, mainstream audiences comfortable, like being, you know, a certain kind of flamboyant, or, you know, making certain jokes and kind of becoming the, you know, the sidekick. I mean, Jack, you know, as the character Will and Grace comes to mind for me there, right? That's a character that is the butt of jokes. But the realities of living as an effeminate, you know, cisgender guy is never really explored with any kind of seriousness. Power is never really contested with any deliberation. Instead, it's just sort of like, oh yeah, we know this overly flamboyant character, ha ha ha, you know, and sort of that's the meat of the thing. And, you know, the lives of people who do live outside of the gender binary never really get explored with any seriousness.
This, of course, I think stands in contrast to the series Pose, with a number of characters who not only are trans, but also are people of color as well. Contrast what you see there as opposed to what we see oftentimes in the general mainstream.
Yeah, it's interesting. Pose just had their series finale a couple of Sundays ago. I'm losing track of time in Pride Month. But you know, just wrapped up a successful third season. As a counterexample to Love, Simon, we do write about the FX series Pose, which actually premiered in the same year, 2018, as an illustration of how Hollywood might tell stories that center queer audiences and queer experiences. Indeed, Pose, as we read it, kind of challenges that dominant deployment of dignity as respectability. And in this, you know, particular depiction of queer and trans life, which they set in the late 80s and eventually the early to mid 90s in the ball world, and specifically trans and queer black and brown communities, we actually see an embrace of excess. We see this sort of insistence on doing the most, on refusing to tone it down, of linking sort of queer oppression with discrimination against black, indigenous, people of color communities. You know, and it really kind of served as a really interesting piece and conversation with Love, Simon, because, you know, at the very same time that Love, Simon says, you know, not that gay, you know, I'm just like you, Pose says, you know, I'm going to do the absolute most. I'm going to center queer histories. I'm going to center queer ways of speaking and thinking and ways of forming kinship and chosen family. I'm going to contest power in ways that make the majority uncomfortable, that indict them, that show the violence. And I'm also going to sort of rupture that neat progress narrative that we're telling about queer communities to show the people that have specifically been left behind. And what I think is the key difference between those shows is that who has a voice at the table, who's shaping the content, actually shapes the kind of stories that are told. You know, Pose serves as a blueprint for how to diversify the writing room, particularly Black and brown, trans and queer folks were at the table as writers, as directors, as executive producers. And, you know, I think when you shape or when you change who has access to content creation, you get a very different narrative.
I want to turn, by the way, to one particular show, which was about Heart Island and the Pine Boxes, in which those who had died were buried in the island. And one of the things that really struck me is how silent all of it was in the AIDS epidemic, in contrast to what we've gone through over the last, say, year. I mean, I'm reminded, for instance, of MSNBC's Nicole Wallace, who at the end of her show during the last year talked about lives well lived. No such recognition of the kinds of deaths that were occurring at the time of the 1980s happened. Tell me a little bit about that contrast and the fact that there was this silence. I mean, obviously the bathhouses were involved in all of this, and it just seems as if the deaths themselves were under the table.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's another thing that Pose does so well, is actually serves as a teaching tool. You know, goes back to sort of, you know, and in some ways kind of does some reparative work, because so many folks don't know those histories, you know, particularly the audiences that are watching Pose that may be a generation removed, you know, or two removed from that early AIDS era. And it's really sort of, you know, reclaiming that history and trying to tell those stories to audiences that don't know them, and trying to actually give a fuller representation of their humanity when it was historically denied to them at the time, especially by the government. I mean, their own communities, it, you know, honored them, but in terms of mainstream recognition of their lives, it really wasn't there. You know, I think we see in the early AIDS crisis, we actually start our book there, because it really is a moment where communities were especially vulnerable, where these deaths were happening to folks that you know, the government and a lot of mainstream society thought were disposable. You know, it was happening to queer people, it was happening to Black and brown communities, to poor people, to sex workers, to drug users. And it wasn't until you know, it really started infecting heterosexual folks, hemophiliacs, children. Then, you know, the narrative began to shift, but there were still clear lines drawn in the sand of, you know, who was an innocent victim versus who was a guilty victim. But we really did see a fundamental devaluation of queer life, to your point, mass unmarked graves. And, you know, a complete lack of mourning and, you know, at the time, queer communities were not able to protect their loved ones, you know, in hospitals and funeral arrangements and negotiations of estates. So that actually was a moment when dignity started doing its work. I mean, the state ultimately gave a kind of ultimatum, you know, be dignified or die. Or be dignified, or don't have the rights that you need to protect and honor your loved ones. So it actually is a really interesting moment that we start in as a kind of a generative jumping off point to kind of map our argument about why dignity was very seductive at a certain point in time, but how it's sort of become an ideology that is perhaps not serving us the way that we think that it is.
Well, we've been speaking with Timothy Lyle. He's co-authored a book, Disrupting Dignity, Rethinking Power and Progress in LGBTQ Lives. And, of course, there's much more in the book, including an examination of how the Supreme Court is treating dignity. And I encourage people actually to take a look at the book. It's a fascinating history and a fascinating look at LGBTQ lives. And, Timothy, we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
The depiction of African-American women has often been stereotyped, but they are fighting back. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Moya Bailey has written a new book entitled Misogynoir Transformed, Black Women's Digital Resistance. It explores the images that have been portrayed and the efforts by many to fight back against them in a digital age. We have her on the phone this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So define for me, first of all, what is misogynoir?
Yes. My easy definition, it is anti-Black racist misogyny that is directed at Black women. So one of the many ways that misogynoir shows up is in the narratives and representations of Black women we see in media, and particularly in this moment, thinking about how it circulates in digital media. So some common examples of misogynoir that we've seen in the media recently include people's reaction to Naomi Osaka and her trying to protect her mental health, and then the assumption that she shouldn't do that and that she should be very much participating in the press and all of the things that are actually impinging on her sense of wellness. And that idea that Black women are still supposed to show up for other people at the expense of themselves is one of those classic stereotypes that misogynoir really pushes forward. So not just Naomi, but I'm also thinking about Meghan Markle. Meghan Markle being another Black woman whose mental health really was jeopardized because of how the press and media were talking about her and the representations they were using to portray her and portray her life. So these are just two examples of how I see misogynoir operating in mainstream culture and really showing that it has real material effects on Black women's lives.
I want to sort of reach back here, too, because there are, I guess, a set of very common stereotypes, Sapphire, for instance, being one, Mammy another. Tell me then a little bit about that history.
Sure. So there are a couple of stereotypes that have existed for a very long time, and actually as I was coming to think about misogynoir, it's those old stereotypes that still get represented and have morphed a little bit but still exist today that got me thinking about the need to name misogynoir. So Sapphire is an old stereotype about the angry, emasculating Black woman. It comes from a radio program turned TV show, Innocent Andy, and looking at the character Sapphire, who was this loud, angry Black woman. And that caricature is something that we can see in contemporary media when people represent and portray Black women in a similar fashion. There's also, of course, the Mammy stereotype that you mentioned that we can see not just in early film like Gone with the Wind, but also in some contemporary products. So there's been a move, actually, because of people's pushback in the uprisings orchestrated by a lot of Black Lives Matter organizers that pushed companies like Uncle Ben and Aunt Jemima to change their representation because it was calling back to some of these earlier stereotypes. And those stereotypes, even though they seem benign, actually have an impact on how we imagine and see Black women in our world. So I see our current advocating and activism really shaping and changing the narrative.
By the way, one of the things that has struck me over the years is Black men portraying Black women. And I personally have never been a big fan of the of that particular comedy. How did that come about? To me, it's a very strange phenomenon. I'm not sure you get it reflected in any other side of society. What's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's this idea that a man in a dress is always funny. There's an idea that Black men and men in general portraying women is already comedic because there's an idea that men and women are so disparate from each other that it's always comical for a man to take what is imagined to be a less privileged position, the the position of the woman. Black women are already masculine and already unattractive because, in essence, there is this man at the heart of who they are. That really ends up enacting a lot of violence, particularly on trans communities, because it suggests that, you know, trans women are just like these comedians pretending to be women and actually are just men in dresses. And so that men in drag trope has particular consequence for black women and black trans women.
I mean, does this have a long history that reaches beyond what our current media is? I mean, obviously with Tyler Perry and so on, but I mean, does this reach beyond that? I mean, where does this originate?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can go back to some of our earliest forms. I mean, even beyond what we imagine in the Americas. I mean, we can go back to Shakespeare and think about all of the women in Shakespeare's plays being performed by men. This idea that, and then that sometimes being comedic, depending on how it was depicted, you know, breaking the fourth wall and letting people in on the joke that you are, in fact, a man, that is a tradition of theater that is really wrong. But it still has this effect of making women seem not actually not actually deserving of kindness or being seen as less deserving of care than if women were actually portrayed by women. There's something about that addict drag that makes it a comedic performance that ends up doing some work to devalue and say that women are not actually worthy of attention on their own. So I really think that we have to do some larger unpacking, even beyond the context of misogynoir, to think about what about women being in theater, being a part of our traditions and ways of performing. Why is that considered funny? So thinking more deeply about how the gender binary is playing out in some of our classic forms of entertainment is going to be necessary as well.
Before we get into the digital pushback, the other thing that you brought my attention to was this sort of mocking and viral form of black women. There's just a sort of series of cuts in which they sound, the closest I can think of is like Valley Girls, but I mean, there's sort of this sort of mindlessness. Tell me a little bit about that genre. I mean, it seemed very strange. I'd never seen it before, and I went on the web. Actually, I went online to take a look at what you were talking about.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of humor that people find in men dressing up as women, and part of that humor, I think, is the ability to see the man underneath. One of the things I talk about in the book is how we still get the facial hair of the man, that there's something that is comedic, usually a very bad wig that is put on. So, again, reinforcing this idea that women are not attractive and that part of their hyper-confidence is something to laugh at because, obviously, they just are men in drag and so, therefore, not beautiful, therefore, worthy of derision and laughter.
I mean, there seems to be in these self-centeredness that it gets displayed or acted out. I mean, where does that come from?
Honestly, I think there's just something that we have internalized as a society that there's something funny about somebody from a privileged position taking on the mannerisms of somebody with less privilege. So I see this also in terms of, you know, people mocking the elderly or other types of derision that happen across hierarchies of privilege. But this one, the specific gender-based one, has, again, real consequences for how black women are treated in society and how people are taken seriously, and leads to a lot of the idea that, you know, women are not to be taken seriously. So it's something that really gets missed. And if you think about why this is actually funny, what is it that people are actually laughing at? It's rarely ever an actual joke. The joke is the fact that it is a man in a dress. That is part of what it is that people are laughing at. And so we have to get closer to unpacking why we find that humorous, I think, to shift and change how we then treat people across the gender spectrum in our society.
So you go on, of course, to talk about a lot of the digital pushback against these images. Tell me a little bit about that world that seems to be opening up.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's different now is that because things are on the internet, because things have the ability to circulate more quickly, the concept and practice of things going viral is that there are more opportunities for people to see these representations, and these representations circulate much more quickly. So one of the ways that Black women are actually responding to that is by creating and challenging those platforms and those mechanisms by turning them against themselves. And that's what I call digital alchemy, this practice of taking the platforms that are available and those very same platforms that are circulating misogynoir and flipping them to your own benefit to actually challenge some of those negative representations. And a couple of the places that I look at that in the book are through the hashtags that Black women create, through the web series that they create, and also the kinds of content that they curate on Tumblr. So people are creating what it is that they want to see, definitely indirectly and sometimes directly challenging what is circulating in mainstream and more popular venues.
Do you think that we're seeing a shift or a change in public perception when it comes to particularly women of color?
Yes. Yes, I do think we're seeing a shift. I just am thinking about the fact that when I started writing the book, Janet Mock was known, but definitely known as a writer and author, and now has gone on to write and produce and direct episodes of the FX series Pose, which is now, of course, a mainstream platform talking about and celebrating the lives of trans women, particularly trans women of color. And that show, I don't think, would have been possible without some of the digital organizing that Janet herself participated in and that other trans women of color really helped to proliferate. So we've seen just in a few short years a real transition in how people are imagining and experiencing trans representation in popular media. But there's a caution here and a caveat in that even representation isn't an end or end in itself, that sometimes representation also creates the possibility for more violence. So we've actually seen one of the deadliest years on record in terms of trans women being murdered already. So there's always a bit of backlash that happens as people are gaining visibility. So how do you negotiate greater representation, and of course, the inevitable backlash?
We've been speaking with Moya Bailey. She's written a new book called Misogynoir Transformed, Black Women's Digital Resistance, and we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.